Hi everyone, my name is Eugenia Chow and I run the Instagram account Eugrenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism and anyone can get involved. Peggy Chan, famously known for spearheading the sustainable slow food movement in Hong Kong, is one of Asia's most authoritative voices on organic sourcing and sustainable food systems. By introducing award-winning restaurant concepts such as Grassroots Pantry and Nectar, she has set a new standard for conscious dining in Hong Kong and beyond. In this episode, we discuss the unsustainability of our current food system, what progress entails, whether or not a business can ever be green within a capitalist society, and how individuals can contribute to changing the system. So firstly, could you please tell us a bit about your background? When/why did you become interested in sustainable food systems, and what is your mission?
Okay, so my name is Peggy, and I started a business about 8 years ago, and it was a restaurant cafe business in Hong Kong, and the whole idea was to really raise awareness of where our food comes from, to use that restaurant platform to kind of educate or share ideas and to kind of create those links that have been broken within our food system together. So I started working in food and beverage 20 years ago. So I was 16 back then, and my first job was at Starbucks, and I kind of just fell in love with working in that kind of repetition because I felt that as someone who is like obsessing, that kind of work mode was the best suited for me. And when you're working in food and beverage, especially in restaurants or coffee shops and such, you're really forced to be doing one thing 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 10,000 times until you master it. So I kind of just fell in love with that. I then went to culinary school in Canada before I went to Switzerland for hotel and business school. So just by working my way up, I could see the food system as a whole, from producer to, you know, the final consumer, and understand the system very well. So how I actually started to become more interested in sustainable food systems was, I made the decision as a teenager to completely quit red meat. So I stopped eating red meat at 16 or 15 years old, and then slowly cut down on my poultry, fish, seafood, dairy. I never really drank dairy. I'm kind of like borderline allergic or intolerant. I slowly kind of cut down on that. But the first time I really got interested in the mission or where food actually comes from was from an article I read on Gourmet magazine in 2004, and now it's like a defunct magazine, food magazine. But it addressed the issue of GMOs. And it was the first time I've ever even learned about GMOs. This was in 2004. And no one really talked about it. My school didn't teach me about it, at least. You know, I went to Cordon Bleu, no one told me about it. So then that really opened up my eyes. Like, I thought that, you know, cows were roaming on the grasslands and, you know, having a happy life. I thought that plants were grown, you know, without all those crap being added to it. But then I learned about Monsanto and what it did. And that's when I really got fired up about, like, how can we allow such injustice to happen in the world? So then it was kind of like the beginning of the internet. And so throughout my university schooling between 2005 and 2007, I basically used that time to do a lot of research on the food system and food politics, and read all these books about, like, you know, from Eric Schlosser from Michael Pollan, from Alice Waters, to really, and Wendell Berry, to really understand like how it used to be before World War II, how it used to be before 1960s, before Silent Spring came, the book Silent Spring was published, how it used to be before the whole organic industry came about. And then I realized, you know, it's definitely big business that has completely changed the way that we produce food, manufacture food. It's, you know, capitalism that has actually driven our planet to its detriment. So with those 2 years in university, I kind of like vowed to use my platform and my, well, I wouldn't say I didn't have any platform back then, but I vowed to use my career as a way to advocate and a way to kind of change the system. And without knowing everything about the system, you can't really change anything. You know, you need to build your credentials, you need to ask questions, you need to learn like what isn't right, what is right, and then kind of create your own set of ideals and set of like philosophy as to where our food system should be heading towards. So that's what happened. And then fast track, after working in hotels for a couple of years, I decided that I needed to do something with more meaning. And that's when I opened Grassroots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you mentioned how our current food system is broken. Could you elaborate more on this and talk about like the limitations or drawbacks of our current food system?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, where do we even begin when it comes to, you know, drawbacks and limitations? Because it is so fragmented and broken. So currently our food system is designed as a linear food system, or sometimes as a web. Okay. So when we talk about production cycle, the food that is grown right now isn't traced. So if you were to go to a supermarket, you purchase something, you look at labels, but the labels don't actually tell you where it's coming from, which farm it's coming from, what the animals eat, whether the plants are genetically modified. You know, they force organic farmers to put in extra money to certify their ingredients as being organic, but what about the GMO certifications, you know? So then, you know, whatever food that is grown, it's difficult to trace. And so when it's difficult to trace, we don't ask questions because we don't know what questions to ask. And where it needs to be traced is in transparent. So like I said, you know, GMOs, RBGH, growth hormones, antibiotics being injected into animals, are those actually labeled? No, you know, because they know, the big businesses know that if my food is labeled as such, people won't buy it, right? All the way down to the waste cycle. So waste is not currently designed to be consumed back into the earth as nutrients for soil, which technically should be. Nature has it designed that way so that whatever we create or whatever is produce goes back into the earth. So with that means all that waste is going into landfills. It's being, whether it's being incinerated, at the end of the day, it's generating countless amounts of methane and carbon dioxide. So that's another fragmented part of our food system and a massive drawback. So then I'm, you know, when you want to break it down into the different parts, we call it, so production, manufacturing, to retail, distributors, retail consumers, then waste. All those pieces are currently fragmented. There are no link or chain within those parts of our food value chain. People working within those parts don't understand the effects a single decision it has on the next part of the chain. So, and we're not taught to do that, you know, where we've always, you know, we've always thought or knew that food and beverage is, those jobs are given to people who have not graduated, people who are misfits, you know, they're ex-cons and, you know, immigrants. But like, we have so much power in food and beverage and food industry to really change the course. So we're given these very specific jobs, like a packing plant. That worker is packing meat in a bag, vacuum packing it in a bag for 8 hours a day, and that's the only job that he or she has. And he or she aren't actually taught to other things. You know, they're not taught about like what, you know, they're not taught to question what is whether this makes sense or not. They're not taught to question whether meat slaughtered this way is humane or ethical. So we're given these like very sterile and inflexible SOPs, we call standard operating procedures. And down all the way down to now, you know, restaurants, chefs in restaurants actually have a massive platform, especially through media, to be able to enact change. But none of that has ever been like a chef being an advocate is such a new phenomena. It never even occurred until pretty much the hashtag MeToo movement, then hashtag plastic oceans, and then the Guardian article that was published about 2 years ago, where it stated like we only really have 12 years to limit climate change catastrophe. Only until then did restaurants start to like freak out. And people started to say, hey, you need to address these issues because you're accountable now. You know, whether it's in sexual harassment issues, so we're talking about social issues within the food value chain, then we're talking plastic oceans. Hey, look at the waste that you're consuming. Now address and be accountable for the waste that you're producing. And then all of that being linked to climate change and livestock production. So it was really in the last 3 to 5 years that we finally took restaurants and restaurant operators and decision makers seriously and to include them into this conversation. Whereas previously, we have always left the environmentalists to deal with environmental issues. We've left the nutritionists to deal with people's health issues. But we have never thought of chefs in restaurants becoming a part of those solutions. So
Yeah.
that's where I'm going to close it
Yeah, I think your two restaurant concepts, Grassroots and Nectar, have always been ahead of their time. So, what do you think makes these, I guess, especially Grassroots, since that was your first project, what do you think makes Grassroots unique, and what was your long-term vision for these restaurant concepts?
I can't be the one to say, but what we've always been told was that people, when they come to eat at ours, they can always trust the origins of the ingredients. So they feel safe dining with us. Like it's not a fast food chain, but they're getting a proper dining experience, which was very, very, very rare back then. So they saw it as like unique because we've created an educational experience in a proper dining setting.
Yeah. So how do you think a restaurant like Grassroots or Nectar with a more slow living organic concept fit into Hong Kong's fast-paced environment?
Well, it doesn't fit in, and we've never created to fit in. We never, anything that we did, we purposely went against the status quo. I think that's why people were really intrigued because they were like, how, almost questioning how would you even survive? You know, how there are so many restaurants in Hong Kong, how do you even outlive the rest, you know, the massive chains? So yeah, that's our legacy.
Yeah, so I guess along that same line, what have been some of the greatest obstacles or challenges so far with running these restaurants and just doing the work that you do in Hong Kong with regards to food systems?
Well, first and foremost, I have to say that any kind of challenge or obstacle, and we see it every single day, even like whether it's a very minute thing like pipe has burst it, you know, or down to, you know, customers complaining that we still serve eggs or something like that, or down to even larger, more, you know, financial decisions that we have to make. And so we can either see these obstacles as being like, oh man, you know, like, and complain about it, or we see them as opportunities. So, I mean, the last 2 years, definitely with the changing market, has been the most difficult, and hence why it was my decision to close the restaurants for that same reason. You know, we designed the restaurant to be long-term sustainable in a way that we could, you know, pay people properly. We can serve good, clean food at more affordable prices. And we can do all those things on the social end at the same time while running the restaurant. But in the last 2 years, it had become so difficult because of, you know, whether it was the price influx in labor costs, or, and that's completely fine. We also believe that, you know, workers should be paid more, but society is not running fast enough for that. Everything is becoming so much more expensive. And so combined with the crumbling economy and the trade wars, and then obviously the politics last year, then all the way down to COVID, it just meant that, you know, people's purchasing power became lower and it was decreased. So, you know, when we first opened at 108 in 2015, we were doing 2.5-3 times more business than we did towards the end of 2019. So like, it's hard to, you know, it's, you have to make certain decisions at the right time, even though it might sound like it's like a loss, but at the same time, this opportunity has also given us more opportunities to create greater change and faster change, you know? So, So I think that we have to take all that into consideration.
Yeah. So you mentioned how, of course, with the pandemic, a lot of business has been affected, but I think, as we know, Hong Kong relies a lot on like imports from China, and a lot of our food is like dependent on external regions.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say this pandemic has revealed about our food systems being unsustainable?
Yeah, I would say that what the pandemic has actually revealed is how fragile our food value chain is, or entire food system is.
Mm-hmm.
And between, not just like within each part of the food value chain, so not talking about like supermarkets, not talking about consumers, not talking about just restaurants or the farms, but in between it, and how all of that creates a domino effect. So, you know, we now know that commoditized food in the giant agribusinesses would rather force farmers to cull the animals, dump their milk, you know, throw out their vegetables, versus feeding local communities in need. We now know this because it's been reported. We now see that if restaurants are forced to close, and farmers who are reliant on restaurants, and those restaurant chains like McDonald's and Burger King's and stuff, if farmers rely on those chains to operate and those chains close, the farmers will suffer imminently. So it's really bringing about like this interconnection that we should see within our food value chain that has always been broken. And I guess this really allows the media and, you know, journalists to talk more about it and to raise those issues. But on the upside, we're also seeing like with the pandemic, we're also seeing that there, with less activity, there's less energy used, less flying. You know, global carbon emissions have decreased by at least 17% compared to the same time last year. And now people are also more aware than ever of not just only food safety issues, but also health issues related to livestock production. So, you know, the meat consumption in China has also decreased. So pork consumption has dropped 35%, while people are becoming more aware that there are alternatives out there. So I'd say that the lesson that is taught through the pandemic is that self-resiliency and also like sustainability as a term is never to only rely on one single mode of income or business. You know, we really need to be diversifying our customer base and diversifying our skills, diversifying our knowledge. So like what I said earlier before we started the interview is like, you know, it's actually the perfect time to be kind of piecing your own mode of knowledge. Yes, I mean, there are things that we can learn in a set structure, but culinary is never just going to be culinary again. You know, if you're going to be a chef, you're not just going to be a chef. You will be a chef advocate or chef nutritionist, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really raised up a lot of the things that we needed, or sped up the things that we needed to know quicker. Yeah,
it's definitely important to be like have a versatile skill set now and be able to combine mm-hmm. those different skills in whatever you do.
Mm-hmm.
So from a Hong Kong standpoint, a lot of us are unable to intervene in the food supply chain. Most of our roles are as consumers when it comes to the food industry. So how do you think we as individuals can support sustainable food systems without being overwhelmed by its complexities? And how can we all contribute to championing a more sustainable food system?
Yes, although the city itself does import over 97% of its food, mm-hmm. we as consumers are actually the most powerful when it comes to changing, or when it comes to dictating what we want to be sold on supermarket shelves. Just take, you know, the Beyond Meats and Impossible as an example. I mean, they've done a great job on the marketing end, and hence also getting consumers to believe that it's the better option compared to meat, just in general. But at the same time, because of consumers' interests and their demands, they've had to, you know, supermarkets have had to kind of shove the quantity of actual meat and dairy aside, decrease those volumes, and increase plant-based options. So that also gets then filtered down to the producers and manufacturers, and you know, big meat industries are suffering right now. They want to say that they're doing a lot still, but they're truly suffering because of people's changing demands. So I would always say vote with your dollars, and you have to, you know, with every single meal that you are consuming, you're really making the decisions for how you want our planet to be conserved, and also how you want our future children to live, you know.
Yeah, I mean, so it's currently a pretty big privilege to be able to consume food that's healthy, organic, sustainable, especially in Hong Kong, where I think it's still an emerging market in Hong Kong. So how do you think we can make organic and nutritious food more accessible for all people?
I think what you like, from your point of view, when you're looking at like healthy, organic, sustainable, it's kind of like packaged in a restaurant setting, you know. What most people are seeing as is like, oh, if I want a healthy meal at Grassroots, I have to pay, you know, $150 for a beverage and a lunch, you know, type of thing. And that's not affordable in an expensive city in Hong Kong. But actually, if you're buying it on your own and making it on your own and doing it on your own, it will be so much more cheaper, you know, because you're not paying the rent and the labor and the dishwashers and the food cost with it. So, or the other external costs, the rent and all those other external costs with it. So again, back to self-resiliency and sustainability at the end of the day is really being able to do it yourself, do everything yourself, you know, or being able to have several skill sets that you're capable of actually making your own healthy meals. And there are tons of resources out there for doing that. I also say that you purchase directly from the farmers, because actually that cuts off the cost of the middlemen. Even though there's a, you know, they're doing good things helping bring food from farm to table, direct from farm to table. But if you want to purchase, if you want to be able to eat a more affordable, healthy meal, you can easily get food from the farm, get ingredients from the farm, buy just organic and highly nutrient dense. So, you know, choosing brown rice versus just white rice, you know, getting more nutrients in versus more empty calories in. And therefore also that changes your body makeup. It's, you stop craving for like snacks and like in between meals and like large portions and all that. If you start to consume more nutrient dense food, your body ultimately feels satiated. And once your body feels satiated, you need less at each time because the food itself is so nutrient dense. So I mean, it's all kind of like is connected. And once you make one decision, the next one kind of builds up as well. Do make healthy meals on your own. It's actually not expensive. You can make a very delicious nutrient dense bowl in under $10, 10 Hong Kong dollars. So yeah, easy.
I think especially in Hong Kong, since people have smaller spaces, usually don't have a backyard or garden, how do you think we could increase our self-sufficiency in the long run? Do you think this would involve urban farming, or what other suggestions would you have?
Yeah, various types of growing food, whether hydroponic, aquaponic, or anything of that sort. I mean, like 5 years ago, I would have been a bit more positive about where our environmental production department is headed, but now I'm also feeling a little bit to say at the least, discouraged because of how backwards things are moving. And we on as advocates, as well as you know, on the in the business sector, we can only do so much. At the end of the day, you need the government and the politicians to be involved. And if they're unwilling to be involved, then little can be actually changed. So whether we're talking about waste incinerators, you know, food waste incinerators that they're building in Lantau or whatever, and whether they're going to create more infrastructures for recycling and infrastructures for upcycling PLA and CPLA. None of that has been discussed, and it's certainly not a priority at the moment. And so I feel like in the business sector, in the last 10 years, so much have been done and is continued to, we're continuing our work in this sense, but I also feel that we need equal partnerships across the entire industry within various sectors. So it's not just the business sector, it's not just individuals, it's not just the producers, the government needs to be involved as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you suggested having more facilities for like handling food waste and also recycling. But if you were to suggest, say, a policy to the government in terms of attaining like a more just and sustainable food system in Hong Kong, what is the first thing that you would recommend or propose?
Yeah, I would say more resilient food system, maybe not more sustainable, mm-hmm. but, you know, Singapore is coming up with the new agenda 30 by 30. So their agenda is that they would produce at least 30% of their own food by 2030. So that means all of those investments would be now headed towards people who have skill sets in food production, in farming techniques, whether it's again aquaponic, hydroponic, urban farming, or farming on soil, in organic farming. As well, and all the way down to food knowledge. So whether it's in skills and, you know, technical skills in cooking and nutrition, they're putting a lot, the government is putting a lot of investment into that. And I hope that it will ripen, and that it's not just some empty claim, but that's what Singapore is doing. So, and in Sweden, they've just announced that they will be transitioning into a circular economy. So when we see that there are a lot of work being done all over the world. In Hong Kong itself, I really want to be able to see more investments going into this, going into building a more resilient and sustainable future for Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm interested in why you made the distinction between sustainable and resilient.
Well, I mean, there is a huge difference between that, but sustainable could mean, I would say sustainable could mean the entire food system. It would incorporate even down to the policy changes, as well as then I would say down to the consumers and to the waste infrastructures. It's not just food that we're talking about, but when we talk about resiliency, it's about how can we feed our population, you know, how can we keep the money within the economy? How can we support the community on our own? I would say that's what resiliency would mean. So sustainability is a much more broader term for the entire food value chain, how we want to see it. But resiliency is, you know, how can we be resilient in each and every single one of our decisions so that we don't end up facing the issues that we have been facing, you know, with certain food shortages and all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I've had conversations with people about how it's important to increase like food security in Hong Kong. And as you mentioned, like increasing our own self-sufficiency as a society. Mm-hmm. And I think some people tend to brush these ideas off as if they're going against what development is about, or they're going against the idea of like globalization and being able to have a taste of like products from different regions. Do you ever receive these kind of comments about your initiatives, and how do you generally respond to these?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, it's proof that capitalism is one of the biggest reasons for our planet's detriment. Mm-hmm. And we don't have a lot of time to be debating whether, you know, globalization can still be a part of the solution, because it no longer is. We've given it a good 50 years. It's interesting because I studied business. I went to school to learn about, you know, globalization and capitalism. Mm-hmm. It was a school in Switzerland, but the accreditation is a Michigan school.
Okay.
Michigan, yeah, university. So it's interesting because I learned all about American politics and American finance systems, but it just like less at the end of the day, less is more. And it's great that we've opened up so many borders and exchanged ideas and given each other so many opportunities. We've seen ingredients fly, you know, 8,000 miles from one place to another when we could have gotten our own, you know, grown our own. And yeah, I think those ideas are great, but I think it's the end of this kind of this sort of globalization. Let's move towards more localization now. If one place is capable of making oat milk, we should be doing our own oat milk here, you know. Or rice milk or whatever it is.
And yeah, I guess Hong Kong has always been making soy milk as well.
Yeah.
Just turn to that. So as someone who studied business and capitalism and all of that. Do you think running a business under a capitalist system can ever be green?
Yeah, it's interesting because so many plant-based alternatives, businesses are operating within that model and they are succeeding. So you can't say it isn't, mm-hmm. you know. But can it truly be green down the line? I guess it also will depend on shareholders and investors and how those changes affect the decision makers. Capitalism with greed, power, and ego mixed into it mm-hmm. will never, never be able to carry the role of operating an authentic green business. And it takes a lot of like self-discipline and to not fall into the trap of like a business owner being pressured to make X amount of return. So you have to do whatever you can or whatever you have to make that, you know, back. It takes a lot of self-discipline to be able to say, no, that goes against the ethos. We're not gonna, you know, stand by that. And I think green businesses right now have the ones that have gone IPO, they have a leverage, they have a massive platform to be able to kind of drive the way green capitalism is going to look like for the future. Mm-hmm. They're going to set the bar for where green businesses will have to be. And therefore I would say like someone like Oatly, who just got another, you know, who's now worth $2 billion or whatever it is, they in the business sector have the power to be able to change policies now. So they also have the responsibility to move away from Tetra Pak if it can't be recycled. Mm-hmm. They then, you know, when you have so much power, you have more responsibilities and you need to be accountable for the decisions that you make. So I hope that other than focusing on, you know, producing oat milk, flying it all over the world, that Oatly can also focus on how can we ensure that our products are delivered better with less energy, with less waste, less carbon emission, towards the end of its life cycle.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you've ever had to compromise your green values in order to sustain your business or businesses?
Not necessarily. I mean, we've been pushed to try to do that mm-hmm. for several, especially right at the beginning. But I think that, you know, as a business that have operated for close to 8 years, we challenged those preconceptions and survived. So while during this time we were also testing the market when the knowledge wasn't ripe. So everything down from like cold press juicing to serving free water in a restaurant setting to bring in ingredients that were more unknown, so like teff or lion's mane or acai. We were the first to bring acai in. So and then also like turning the vegan to become at over 98%, 99% vegan. That was also a first. And then down to like tracing our consumption and waste habits and producing a sustainability report. So like over the years, there were things that we were constantly trying to challenge the status quo, even though on the outside, there's a lot of things, you know, there's a lot of pressure to do it, you know, for us to do it the way that other people are doing it, you know? So I don't remember a time where I had to really compromise specific green values. And in fact, I've just kind of just, yeah, went ahead and did my thing.
Yeah. And that's really inspiring. So what does development or progress mean to you?
I think progress certainly means that, you know, you will fail some and you will also succeed in others. And that it's okay, you know, you don't have to be perfect, and that you're continuously learning along the way. And you make mistakes, but you also learn from your mistakes and you know that not to repeat it, you know. I think that it's important to like stay humble along the way, no matter how much praise you get or how much like recognition you get, that you're not the only one who knows everything, and whatever you know, strive to share it, strive to inspire others, strive to like keep improving, because you alone can't do everything. You need others to be a part of this movement and to be a part of the change. So yeah, I'd say just keep, you know, progress means that we are always improving. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so what are you working on right now to elevate your positive impact on the environment? And is there anything the community can expect from you moving forward?
Yeah, okay. Well, we transitioned our business into consultancy now. So since January, we have started to work on several projects. One is we're collaborating with a very old food service company. I'm not going to name anything yet. A very old food service company that they're really willing and ready to kind of transition from their old systems and their old ways. And I think those are kind of like the perfect scenarios and perfect collaborations and perfect partnerships, because we can't force people who are not ready to move forward, you know. But once they're ready, then a lot of like magic happens. So that's one project that we're working on. We're also doing a school lunch program, or helping revamp a school lunch program. So they came to us like last fall, and we've finally been able to like completely reassess their menu based on carbon emissions, based on nutrition factors, and then kind of changed and shifted their menu from a 80-20 like meat to veg ratio to now like a 50-50 ratio, pushed them to also move away from the refined salt, sugars, oils, flours to more clean and traceable ingredients, or the more nutrient dense ingredients as well. So that's another one. We've done several other menu development projects, so tons of people come to us for helping them write more clean menus. So there's going to be another partnership there that will be announced soon. And then at the same time, I'm also fundraising for my food edutech platform. So you know, education is such a huge part of grassroots and what I believe in and what I do. And so but there's only one of me. So I hope that with this platform, we can scale knowledge and rewrite the textbooks for the food industry, and be able to get these curriculums to schools, to hotel groups, to food service providers, all across Asia and if not the world. And so that's kind of what I'm working on right now as well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. A lot of exciting projects coming along. So what advice would you give to someone who wants to learn more about sustainability and food systems in Hong Kong, and perhaps wants to get more involved with becoming an advocate for these?
Yeah, I mean, like me, I started off being very curious, right? Curious and also, you know, very angry about the situation, want to do something about it. So my curiosity really led me to do my own research and do my own studies, and it's, you know, it doesn't always apply the same everywhere. So if you want to learn more about Hong Kong, then like talk to people who are within the system, work in it. You know, I worked in some big hotels groups before, and so I saw firsthand the amount of bread that had to be tossed out at the end of the night when it couldn't be sold or couldn't be used, you know? And it's like, but can't we donate it? Can't we have our staff like bring it home, you know? No, we cannot. And, you know, and the whole airline industry is the same. So like, until you actually are immersed in the everyday interactions and the everyday protocols, you can't really understand, you won't fully understand the issues that come about. And so, especially for someone who really wants in that change in food, always do, like, go ahead and do the research and but not be like snobby about things when you know go in and you're like, I want to change the world, but like learn it first. You have to master at something before you can change it. So do the hard work before leading the charge. Yeah, and there's tons of other platforms that you can learn from and get information from as well, you know. Green Queen, there are tons of local farmers who can do like wolfing programs, so you can like work in the farm. Yeah, so there are tons of information out there.
Have you worked on a farm before?
Not like a professional, not professionally, no. Uh-huh. I've been like helping out here and there.
In Hong Kong? Just like a small?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Did you do that through woofing?
No, I mean like, because we source directly from our farmers, right? And we've set up some stalls for them. So right now, in the last year, they've been setting up their stall outside of our restaurant. And we're helping them kind of connect with different restaurant groups and restaurant purveyors so that they can set different stalls all over the island to be able to sell their veg. So again, like kind of like building that resiliency for them. Without this platform, they also said that they wouldn't know how to sell because previously they were doing it at Tong Chong Street Market, which was Swire Group and also HSBC. But once COVID hit, everything had to be shut down and they didn't allow like people to come in and do the markets there. There were no workers, you know, for 2 months. So like without this platform, it's hard for them to like continue to bring their food that's grown in the farms to be sold, you know, and the food's not going to wait around for you. If it's overripe, it's overripe. Yeah. You know? So you have to have kind of like a consistent way of allowing them a platform. So they're in Shangwan 4 days a week, and we're trying to see if they can go down to like Southside a couple days a week as well.
They're still going to Shangwan now?
Yes, they are. They are still there. Okay. Yeah.
Cool. And finally, what is your favorite meal?
My favorite meal?
Yeah, your favorite dish.
Okay. I think I did have it yesterday. I was like feeling so lethargic. I don't know why. I don't know if it's heat or like something I ate or something. So my favorite meal, so simple. It's just steamed brown rice with tons of green veg with like a tahini miso dressing of sorts. With some kraut or like kimchi, like some kind of fermented foods, and tofu or tofu and mushrooms. So it's like that is like a complete meal for me, and it's like, oh, I love it.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out. Also, don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.